Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. My guest this week is Derek Friday, an environmental graphic designer based out of Boulder, Colorado, and Hamburg, Germany. We talk about how he shifted from essentially getting a degree in architecture into doing environmental graphic design, moving around and splitting his time between the U.S. and Germany, and the importance of relationships and collaboration, all right after this. Hey, I've got big news on the Creative South front. If you're listening to this on release day, that's today, Monday, September 15th, then head over to creativesouthga.com at noon Eastern time to pick up your Love is Blind ticket. They go on sale at noon Eastern time. There's only 125 of them. And if it's anything like last year, they'll be sold out in a little over an hour. These early bird tickets are $175. That's $125 less than what the full price ticket will cost you when it goes on sale. So set the alarm on your phone, wake up early if you're on the West Coast, or if you really sleep late, go get your debit card ready, pick up your Creative South 2017 Love is Blind tickets before they're all gone. We're looking forward to seeing you and hugging some necks. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/creativesouth. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts, and you could even get your own podcast episode. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having
me. I'm glad we got the audio headphone situation cleared up and somewhat working where we can hear each other and we're not pantomiming to each other.
Yeah, it's always kind of stressful, especially at the start. When I did Diane's design recharge, I was in Hamburg and there was like a bunch of technical glitches like right out of the gate, and it was just really, I was like, oh no. Anyway, we're good.
You can blame it on being on another continent at that time.
Okay.
So, starting off, where did you grow up?
So, I grew up basically in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the Midwest. I was born in a small town in Ohio. My father worked with Xerox, and he was he had a sales accounts all over the country, but one of his particular accounts was in West Virginia, and we were living in southeastern Ohio for a while in a town called Ironton. But I was officially born in Ashland, Kentucky, across the river. I think my parents...
I know where Ashland, Kentucky is. I went to high school in Kentucky.
Okay. Well, I think my parents felt more comfortable delivering me at the hospital in Ashland versus Ironton. So, but yeah, most of my boyhood life was in Cincinnati, Ohio, with a short period in Springfield, Illinois. So I'm a Midwestern guy.
I am too. I grew up in... Born in Chicago area and lived there till I was about 5, and then we moved to Minnesota and lived there till I was right before high school, and then we moved around a bunch after that. But, so yeah, I'm a Midwestern kid as well.
Lots of Cincinnati Reds and Cincinnati Bengals and Ohio State Buckeyes football, and that was lots of the upbringing.
Gotcha. So when you were a kid, were you big into art, or were you more of a sporty kid? Or
I was definitely a creative kid. I mean, I've had a chance to kind of really think about this a lot. But my uncle was an architect in Chicago. And as a young boy, when we lived in Springfield, Illinois and Cincinnati, we would travel to Chicago and go see my cousins and my uncle. And I still grew up in a really nurturing kind of creative environment, but you know, my uncle was like a real life creative, and he worked on really cool stuff and had a really neat house in Barrington outside of the city.
Oh, I know exactly where Barrington is. My aunt and uncle used to live there. So I used to go there about twice a year for summer and Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. So they live sort of in the country, and they had horses and, you know, a big garden. And of course his house he designed, cause he was an architect. And, I just remember, you know, vividly those experiences. And then he worked on the Marina City project.
Oh, okay.
He was with the construction company, Hugh Construction, that did all the concrete work. I mean, of course, that building is completely concrete. And he designed the formwork for the kind of classic shape of the towers. And then he also designed the mechanisms to remove the formwork. And at the time, it was a pretty, you know, ahead of its time development project. And I think at one point they were the tallest concrete structures in the States. So that was just a really memorable experience, you know, going back and forth to Chicago, kind of seeing the big city, seeing an architect, and then just, you know, just left a real impression on me. And I was always creative, always drawing, always doing art projects, but did grow up playing sports, but not, you know, I wasn't a traditional football, basketball, baseball kind of guy at all. I was more of an outsider, lone wolf kind of guy, but I grew up playing hockey and tennis randomly, the two kind of extreme opposites.
Yeah, those two don't go together.
Yeah, not at all. So I, you know, I got that sort of team experience, but I was definitely always like looking to create or make or do something or build something or, you know, use my hands basically.
Sure. So when you got through school and went off to college, what did you study when you were in college?
So I studied, I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, sort of right on the Ohio, Indiana border. And, for the first year, I didn't really understand what I was doing at all. I mean, I just,
like most college freshmen.
Yeah. I just knew that I wanted to leave home and like, you know, get on with like the next part of my life. But, so it wasn't until I transferred to Miami after a semester at University of Cincinnati that I found out about their Western College sort of interdisciplinary studies program. And then that was also largely where a lot of the kids that were in the environmental design program, which is essentially a 4-year degree in architecture. And then they had a two-year master's degree. So I applied for that program and then completed that program, the 4-year environmental design degree, which, you know, curiously has nothing to do with what I do now, environmental graphic design. They called their undergraduate architecture degree environmental design. So I have that degree. And then I could have stayed on to get a master's in architecture, but you know, as we'll get into this conversation, you'll sort of understand why that didn't happen. So,
sure. So you kind of are laying the groundwork to go into architecture, but decide not to go for your master's. What do you end up doing?
So I moved to Chicago right away, basically. Well, not right away. I had a job with a small architectural office in Covington, Kentucky, right across the river in Cincinnati, and worked for this really nice guy that did church design and some schools. And you know, I was just a brand new out of school, basically intern, didn't have any idea what I was doing. He probably didn't really know how to use me, but I, you know, got a lot of menial tasks running blueprints. I mean, no computers at this point, just hand drawing. I think it was a good experience for me, but I knew I needed, you know, to kind of like jump up a couple of levels, not from like a work, like the type of work or whatever. I just needed to be in an environment where there were lots of people and lots of projects and that I could sort of learn from a lot of different scenarios. This was a small office. And so it was a good first step, but then I basically, got lucky and, one of my best friends from high school, his mother knew a principal at a pretty big firm in Chicago that's still around now called Solomon Cordwell Benz, big commercial, outfit in Chicago, and basically, you know, more or less got me a job. And I sold my used car and bought a new Golf and threw everything that I owned in there and moved to Chicago and started working with a big city, you know, commercial architectural office.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you know, you're working for an architecture firm, which varies kind of significantly. I mean, you do stuff with architectural people now.
Right.
But how do you make that transition from working from an architectural firm where I imagine if you're going in straight out of college and kind of a, you know, junior position, you're doing a lot of drafting drawings and things like that. How do you make that transition into what you do now?
Okay. You have some time?
Oh, yeah.
So this firm, Solomon Cordwell Benz, was actually a really nice office. They did really high-end residential towers, and they did a lot of retail projects, including basically being the exclusive architect for Crate & Barrel. Crate & Barrel was just sort of starting to gain its notoriety, and I arrived at Solomon Cordwell Benz right when they were designing and developing the flagship Crate & Barrel store on Michigan Avenue. So it was like high profile, big deal project.
I was about to say it's either that one or the one in Schaumburg.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the white, it sort of looks like a Richard Meier building. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of, you know, big wigs from Crate & Barrel are coming in. I worked in an office that was really polished and nice design inside, and everyone wore bow ties and had Mont Blanc pens in their pockets. And, you know, it was just like, you know, early 90s kind of stuff. And they knew not to sort of, well, I was doing the kind of stuff that you're talking about, writing blueprints and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they also recognized that I had a real interest for doing things that the clients responded to, like building models and doing presentation drawings and pulling together the visual presentations for client meetings, you know, even down to like arranging the boards or arranging all the materials or just doing things that sort of enhance the experience for the client to buy into the conceptual ideas. Okay. So I quickly became sort of that person there where they could rely on for lots of things that, you know, the client resonated with, beautiful things. And not so much, I wasn't, you know, obviously really involved in the conceptual design per se, but I would take people's designs and then make things look really, you know, pretty or presentable. So that was definitely, you know, my first sign that, you know, I didn't want to be doing, you know, door jam details, you know, just drawing.
Can't imagine why not.
It just wasn't for me, although, you know, technically I'm a lot more interested in that sort of thing now. But at the time, I just like wanted to be a part of everything. And then basically, you know, right when I started to get into my groove, you know, maybe 4 or 5, 6 months into it, I, along with like 50 other people, lost their jobs just like overnight, you know, when the sort of recession hit in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I instantly got pushed over to a high-end corporate interior design firm that was doing equally beautiful work, but for law offices and things like that. So I got immersed into the corporate interior design world. So now all of a sudden I'm experiencing another discipline altogether, you know, more interior-related stuff. The architecture was sort of set, but the interior architecture was what we were impacting. And I learned about materials and really got into furniture and all the classic furniture designers.
Yeah. And to clarify, because I think a lot of people have a misconception, interior design is different than interior decorating. And I think, you know, in this day and age, a lot of people have kind of made those synonymous terms, but they are very different.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I did actually get to do a lot of what were called sort of feasibility study exercises, where if they say, okay, you have these five floor plates in a skyscraper, and they're this size, this square footage, and we need to pack in, you know, 20 attorneys and 20 attorneys assistants and a copy room and a work room and 4 conference rooms. And they need to be, you know, the corners need to be saved for the partners and blah, blah. And, you know, so all of this stuff. So I got into the sort of math, and this is again before computers. So we're doing this kind of stuff by hand. But again, I really ended up gravitating towards communicating the ideas, working under lead, you know, interior designers that were doing space planning, building architectural things inside fixed pieces of architecture. So like stairwells that would go into 4 different levels or, you know, spaces within spaces. So there was, you know, a lot of architecture and things like that, but a lot of finished materials and heavily dependent upon presentation to really sell the clients on things. And again, this sort of passion for furniture design and learning about Knoll and Herman Miller and textiles. And just, so I really got into like this whole new world. Right. Uh-huh. And then again, same thing, you know, people started losing their jobs. And after this interiors group, then I jumped over to a small residential architect in Chicago that was doing custom homes. So then I was instantly put in another scenario where I was, and that, you know, from an architectural standpoint, if I could do it all over again, I think that's the type of architecture that I would really love to practice, residential architecture, because all of my, the small modest homes that we've purchased that have always been ugly and barely what we can afford, you know, it's always about what can you do to transform it and make it better. So I've always been really interested in doing slight modifications architecturally to the houses that we've worked on and, you know, and sometimes some major things. So, you know, someday maybe I could design a place from scratch that we live in. But having this experience working with a Chicago architect was just, again, part of that journey.
Sure.
And then, you know, basically at that point, it just wasn't, you know, something that was long-term. It was a small office. He only had a couple of employees. He sort of was a little bit of a flake in that he just wouldn't show up for a couple of days at a time. And I sort of never knew when I was going to get paid. So that also added a little stress to the situation. So the idea was to just pick up and move to Boulder. We had been in Chicago for, you know, 3 or 4 years out of college, and all of our friends were living in the city, and we figured, you know, we have to leave because everyone else is going to leave soon and we don't want to be left behind. And, you know, there's no way that everyone can sustain their lifestyles in the city. And now most of the people are still there and they all, you know, live in Wicker Park and Bucktown and have since bought houses and maintain that city urban lifestyle. And, Boulder was just sort of the idea instead.
So what was it about Boulder that, you know, cause that's, well, a time zone away, but that's a couple thousand miles away and,
yeah,
you know, very different environments.
Yeah. I mean, as a boy, we used to vacation in Colorado a lot. My family and I, we would come out and ride horses and just sort of be in the mountains. And my mom and dad lived in Colorado Springs. My dad was in the Air Force, and both my sisters were born at the Air Force Academy. He was stationed nearby at an Air Force base. And so they always had fond memories of being in Colorado. So I got exposed to the state, you know, as a youngster. And then Boulder, just, I don't know, there was something about it that was just, I was being drawn to Boulder somehow. It's just the physical beauty, always been sort of an outdoor person. I'm a pretty serious runner. And just the idea of taking off and going to someplace new and someplace that, you know, was mine, because the family was all in the Midwest. And it was just, you know, that sort of point in your life where you just make a big decision and hope that it works out. So in continuing this question, Boulder, you know, didn't have a lot of opportunities, and I didn't know about the one firm that I ultimately ended up in at the time. So I did more or less the same as what I'd been doing in Chicago. I worked with a couple other nice firms in Denver, commuting back and forth, and got, you know, more experience in different ways, schools, university projects, lots of stuff with the national parks. I worked on the Mount Rushmore Interpretive Center at Mount Rushmore, and just worked on a lot of nice different types of projects. And then I heard about this firm in Boulder called ComArts, and, also, one of my firms in Denver, they, you know, they even sort of brought to my attention that, you know, it just seems like you're a fish out of water here. You have these skill sets that are really unique, but they're not following the path of being a traditional architect. And I agreed. So I found this firm, Communication Arts, in Boulder that was started by these two guys, Richard Foy and Henry Beer, and they worked in the Eames office in the 50s.
Okay.
And they basically brought that concept to Boulder. So the office had interior designers, they had architects, they had illustrators, they had typographers, product designers, furniture designers, storytellers, you name it. And this was just heaven to me, you know, the thought of this place. And I developed a portfolio, and I begged, borrowed, and stole, and I stole, and I got an interview, and I got a job at this place, but all with this sort of architectural experience and some interiors experience and some other sort of architecture related, but
sure,
really so none of those other things.
Yeah, I was about to say. So you get there, and you don't have you've got the experience in, you know, the a little bit interiors and the architecture stuff. And then you go to work for this multi-service, multi-discipline amalgamation of a firm. How does that transition, you know, when do you start picking up those habits that make you more on the large-scale graphic design portion of it?
Right, good question. So they hired me to be sort of like an architect guy. And they did a lot of retail projects. That was their sort of bread and butter work.
Sure.
Comart sort of got their start nationally recognized by doing the Pearl Street Mall in Boulder, which is like a European style pedestrian walking street where they stopped traffic on both ends and cleared up like an 8-block part of downtown where it's just pedestrian only. So there was lots of stuff in that area, you know, planters and seating areas and paving patterns and light fixture design and signage and graphics and water features and all these sorts of things. But then retail developers started recognizing what they're capable of, and their bread and butter work was doing shopping mall projects. So I was acting as like an architectural sort of coordinator for all the graphic designers and other people in doing those types of doing that kind of work for retail projects. And I was on the team, but acting as an architect. But I got to watch everyone do their work. And lots of times, you know, and when push comes to shove and people needed to get in there and do things that they maybe weren't able to do as well, or just to make sure that the process moved along, I was able to do some things like work in Illustrator and do some vector projects and do some logo studies and look at some paving patterns and start to get into disciplines that weren't quite in my comfort level, but I knew I loved it, especially signage and wayfinding and typography and pattern design. I was just really intrigued by all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So eventually they started to sort of let me do this stuff, but not to the degree that I really wanted to. And after about 4 or 5 years of being there and just loving the place, I mean, I used to have dreams that I couldn't go to work there the next day, like nightmares, because I liked it so much. I was around so many creative people and it was so inspiring. And the partners were so smart and such motivators that I loved it there. But I knew I knew I had to leave and go get more experience if I ever would be able to impact that place the way I wanted to. So basically, you know, after being there for 5 or 6 years, we picked up and moved, and I moved back to Cincinnati, of all places.
So what was it about? I mean, was it a job opportunity?
I got a job with FRCH, who is a sort of a premier sort of architecture, branding, environmental design sort of outfit that does a lot of work for specialty retail, like individual shops and brands versus like an entire shopping mall.
Sure, kind of like Stark is now.
Yeah, and I built a portfolio that was convincing enough to basically say I could do environmental graphic design, wayfinding, and also my reputation of being at ComArts. They described me as the guy from ComArts because ComArts had such a great reputation, and basically working there for 5 years was worth its weight in gold, and it got me a position at FRCH. That was a 1-year experiment. It wasn't something that we were planning on doing for a long time. My son Finn was basically 1 year old and he was able to be with his grandparents for a year. But the idea was always to keep going or move back. And the next step was Baltimore, where I got a job with RTKL in their environments group. At the time, it was called ID8. And that was a fully immersive branding and graphics and environmental graphic design kind of component.
I remember ID8.
Yeah, to RTKL. And I worked under this guy, Phil Engelke, who was a really, really smart guy. And ID8 was a firm-wide service, but there were only LA, London, and Baltimore locations. So I was able to work on projects all over the world for RTKL in their different offices when they needed branding and graphics people on their projects. So I worked basically, that's when I started getting a lot of international experience working in the Mideast and Europe, and worked a lot in the Chicago and Dallas office for a couple of other really smart principals. And that was a really lovely experience, and Baltimore was a great place to be, and I just really felt fortunate to have this great position and just really honing my skills and getting so much experience. And then all of a sudden, RTKL asked that everyone that was working in the Baltimore office start working in the Washington, D.C. office. And that was going to add about 3 hours onto my commute. So instead of just finding another job in Baltimore, we moved to California. And I went to work with, we've almost come full circle. I was about to say,
you're crisscrossing the U.S. here.
Yeah, we did a 5-year coast-to-coast hiatus. I then went to work with a firm called RSM Design in San Clemente, and they're a premier environmental graphic design firm exclusively, but with the same kind of clients as RTKL, you know, worldwide, and actually worked for some of the same clients that I was working for at RTKL.
Okay. So let me interrupt here because we're kind of merging into this. For people who aren't familiar with what environmental design is, and, you know, to be honest, when I the first time we talked, I had to look it up.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't something I was familiar with. And immediately when I heard it, I was like, okay, so it's just wayfinding? And then, you know, I realized it expanded past that. But can you kind of, give the short synopsis of it?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, I probably tell this, I answered this question in a lot of different ways, but essentially, beyond the built environment, beyond the let's use like a museum or a restaurant, for example, there's there's an architectural sort of component, a box, like, you know, a four walls and a ceiling and the skin of the building and the articulation on the exterior of the building and the spaces inside. But environmental graphic design, I'd like to say, sort of adds like it sort of starts the blood pumping through the project. And that can come in the form of signage and graphics, patterning and the floor materials, specialty elements in the space like lighting elements or furniture design or lighting design. Integrated branding aspect. So if the project has like a brand, how do you manifest that brand within the internal environment? So lots of retail projects that I work on are largely sort of influenced by large surface graphics that are sort of part of the brand or the identity of the project. Color palettes usually come into play and signage and wayfinding.
Okay, so you're taking all of those elements and doing a holistic view and figuring out how to incorporate everything where it makes sense and it gives flow and direction and breathes life into it, kind of like you said.
Exactly, and for large retail projects, lots of times I'll work with the architects to help create a different kind of experience as you enter the project. So that might be in the form of, you know, the physical architecture, the way the entry looks and feels, if there's graphics that are part of the entry, and those graphics could still come in the form of architectural materials versus just printed graphics. I mean, you can create texture and graphics with architectural building materials and the way that it's illuminated. I mean, there's lots of ways that it can sort of manifest itself. If you have a brand and you understand what the brand means and how it's supposed to move people, then as part of your design exercises as an environmental graphic designer is to take that brand essence and then try to visually communicate it in a lot of different ways beyond just the architecture. So that might be another way to explain it.
Okay. So if you're taking, say, using architectural elements and you've got this big wall and, you know, the client saying, I don't want any graphics up there, but I want it to have depth and texture, you could say do this and I'm just throwing this out there, you could do a concave and convex pattern kind of into the texture of the wall, and the way the light reflects off of it will create a pattern on the opposite.
Right. And those patterns that are created might have some connection to like the meaning of the brand or what the product is about or the sort of experience that they want the visitors to have. Maybe it reads differently at night, which is part of the experience. So it's really about, enhancing the experience of the place, giving it that extra level of sort of life and soul and purpose beyond this sort of static architecture. And there's sure. nothing wrong with monumental architecture. A lot of museums and churches sort of have those effects. But I think you'll find more and more now that environmental graphics and integrated branding are becoming more a part of the built environment now. And if you think about, sort of historically, ancient cities and tombs and like the Acropolis, for example. I mean, all of those structures were adorned with gold leaf and paintings and storytelling on the surfaces. So
right.
that's just one sort of two-dimensional version of environmental graphic design, but it can manifest itself three-dimensionally as well.
Okay. So getting back into it, you're in California, you're in San Clemente working for this firm. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, so that was a really nice experience too, because I got to work on some really, really wonderful projects. But ultimately, just San Clemente was not for me. It just wasn't.
It's not one of those towns you hear people talk about fondly a lot. So
yeah, I mean, it just wasn't for me. But I had a lot of great experiences in California and met a lot of really nice people. But Boulder was, even prior to that, Boulder was still sort of like, I was ready to get back.
Sure.
And where I came back to, I came back to ComArts. And now I had this world of experience and I had clients and I had, and I was ready and empowered and excited about, sort of bringing as much to the table as I had learned over these years. And, so, again, just victim to the, economy and what was going on, but, in 2008,
I think we've all been through that many times.
Yeah. In 2008, everyone sort of knew what was happening. But so the firm, almost right away when I got back, the firm sort of was cut in half, size wise. But fortunately I had this client, from Germany that, sort of allowed me to bring in projects to this new agency that he had never really worked with before.
Sure.
And gave us a chance.
And the listeners can't see you're actually wearing a Hamburg hat at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Coincidentally. So when people were losing their jobs, myself and a couple of colleagues, we were busy with work and sort of got my first, I was able to bring in work and keep some people busy, and we kept as many people as busy as possible, but, we can only do so much. So during the time that everyone was losing their jobs, we were in Istanbul and in Berlin and all over Europe working on three or four major projects that really sort of enabled his career as a design director at ECE, in Hamburg to take off.
Okay.
And ComArts at the time was doing their best to keep people busy and doing everything they could to keep the doors open. But there were lots of rumblings and rumors about, things that could potentially happen, including buyouts. And, the partners, unfortunately, had to do what they had to do. And they sold the company to a large Canadian-based engineering firm with, 40 or 60,000 people and just... It just sort of transformed the place, as you can imagine.
40, 60, so ACOM.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically, ComArts was just a service of their multiple services, including, water treatment plants and highway overpasses. And there's nothing like this boutique agency that I have been
sure.
working with.
So I work for an engineering firm, so I'm literally going, okay, I know there's really only about two or three firms that are about that size.
Stantec.
So it's either, yeah.
Okay. So Stantec bought the company and, they were really excited about it and kind of told us all these wonderful things. And, I just the whole time I'm thinking, well, I just don't care about this because I have, you know, my client in Germany and I'm just going to keep doing this and not have to worry about it. But I was asked to be in the sort of leadership role transition sort of, so myself and two other people were put in this more sort of, I don't want to call it management role because we were still being designers and cranking out packages and doing everything like normal. Sure. But then all of a sudden inundated with, you know, 500 emails a day, corporate policy stuff. And
I know that feeling well.
Yeah. It was just not for me at all. And it's fine for some people, but it wasn't for me. And I dealt with it for about a year. And then my client in Germany, so we're getting really close here. My client in Germany said, hey, please feel free to leave that company. Nothing's going to change for you. I've got so much work. You know, we can keep working as long as you want. So basically, sure. I parted on good terms with Comard Stantec and basically have been, you know, my own entity ever since for about six or 7 years now.
Okay. And then I noticed you said that your son is named Finn. So the Findustry, I'm assuming, comes after
Findustry was originally an idea to be sort of like a parent company that little idea companies could live underneath that, none sure. of which ever happened. And Findustry just became a blog. For a long time, I ran Findustry.com, which is just a blog where I shared, you know, findings and insights and some of my work and lots of other people's work, and just had this visual tool that I could use to celebrate ideas and have as an archive for reference. And it was at a time when I could, you know, dedicate, you know, honing my writing skills and, you know, really using the blog tool as like a, you know, a real useful thing. And you know, enjoyed it for a really long time. And it's still up, but at the time when I left Comart Stantec, I felt like it just made sense to keep that as the name. So Findustry has just stayed my sort of company name, essentially.
Gotcha. So now you work, you know, essentially for yourself. The company in Germany is still kind of your biggest client. And you kind of still are bouncing all over the world quite a bit. So how does that work, balancing that with a family life? Because how many kids do you have?
Two.
So you got two kids, you get a wife, dog or cat somewhere probably.
Dog.
when you're having to travel like that? Because I remember, I think you were gone for a week or two over in Hamburg. So how are you balancing your life out with that?
Yeah. So Hamburg, basically, it's been a little bit different since last fall, but essentially for the first 5 years, I was going about every 6 to 7 weeks for 2 week periods. And, okay. You know, everyone here is really supportive because they know that I'm just working hard for the family and doing what it takes. And I'm also around every night for dinner and on the weekends, except for when I'm sure. traveling and I'm not working late night at the offices and things like that. I can just come back in my little space here and work. But it's working fine. I'm trying to shift the curve a little bit so that I'm not there as much. And I've been working really, really hard this past, you know, like 6-9 months on getting more domestic work and nurturing the relationships that I have here domestically too. So, you know, the one thing that's enabled that to happen is that my goal and what I really like to do is collaborate. I don't like sitting in this room by myself, making all the decisions by myself. So when I go to Hamburg, I really enjoy being immersed into their creative design department and working collaboratively. So I've taken sure. that same concept and I make myself available as a collaborator for a lot of different people around the country and a lot of different projects. And I bring in a lot of work myself, but then I share it intentionally with, you know, a handful of people around the country that I know have the same sort of sensibility that I do, same work mm-hmm. ethic, and know that collectively we'll, you know, do really nice projects together. So the travel is still basically as much as it was before, but you know, it's also sort of interjected with a lot of domestic projects as well. So that's helping things. But I also need to get out, and I need to be constantly inspired by experiences and
sure.
meeting new people and going to new places. And fortunately, the projects that I'm working on in Germany are all over Germany, or lots of projects in Poland lately, mm-hmm. Czech Republic, Hungary, a few projects in Italy, Turkey. So I'm getting around. I'm
it's a good excuse to travel to some really beautiful places.
Yeah, no, it's nice. I'm really lucky. But Hamburg is kind of almost become a second home, and
sure.
I'm really enjoying it there too. So the travel is just sort of just when I'm getting a little tired of being there is around the time that I'm, you know, coming home.
Gotcha.
But it is sort of a funny experience because now that I've been doing it for so long, sometimes I kind of don't know where I belong in a way. And when I get here, I'm itching to get back and vice versa. So it's to add another component to that, I think it's going to help. And I've been working a lot in Baltimore with colleagues from RTKL that now have their own agency. So I'm mm-hmm. really holding on to all these relationships that I've had along the way from different offices, and know that I can depend on, you know, these friends and colleagues to work on projects. And I will literally go after projects that I know I absolutely can't handle on my own, knowing that that I can rely on some of these other people. And even just like going to Creative South this year, I mean, mm-hmm. just meeting all the people that I met there and knowing what that family environment is like and knowing all those skill sets, I am actively, you know, continuing to talk to people from Creative South, you know, discussing how we might be able to work on a project together or plug into a project together and just continue those relationships because
sure.
you know, the one relationship that I have in Hamburg has been the most powerful one from a professional level. He's also a great personal friend, but collaborating and the power of working with friends and nurturing those relationships to do the things that we love to do and also build upon just interpersonal relationships is really the most fulfilling thing about what I'm doing now.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, for me, that was kind of my whole reason behind starting the podcast is, like I said, I work for an engineering firm. I'm pretty much the lone creative there. So I get in this isolated bubble, and the area I'm in, while there are a lot of designers, there's not a good design community. So meeting all those people just doesn't happen around here. So I've got to get out. So when I, you know, stumbled on up to Creative South a few years back, that really opened things up. And then this was just kind of a continuation of it to be able to talk to more creative people. So that those building those relationships, is really important. And I think a lot of people miss that too, though, is, you know, when you bounce from job to job and do things like that, it's a lot of people are just, I'm moving on to the next thing instead of keeping those relationships and keeping those connections and, or at least trying to keep those connections.
Right. I mean, I found that, you know, and lots of times I kind of, you know, wish that people were like me and that they want to keep the relationship going or it's, you know, don't adopt this sort of out of sight, out of mind, but I'm sure. like the best friend you'll ever have. You know, I mean, I really, really value meeting people and having those work experiences and life experiences with, and just because I go to a new location, I'm still going to stay in contact with you in some form or another. And when you least expect it, all of a sudden, you know, we're working on a project together and we're in the same room together during a work session or something. That's what I really value. Cause I also kind of take the attitude that, you know, who knows what can happen? Why can't we work on this project together? It's ultimately just about ideas and right. You may not have the exact skill set, but we'll figure out how to, you know, communicate those ideas, but it's about our minds getting together, collaborating, solving these problems, coming up with solutions. And that's just what I get the most fulfillment out of.
Well, yeah. So if you can, you know, meet those people and collaborate with them, excuse me, they're going to probably bring different things to the table that you hadn't thought of. And
exactly.
It can expand and open things. And they may not, like you said, they may not have the same skill set, but they're looking at it from a different perspective that opens the doors in other ways.
Right. And I always like to say that, you know, two minds around a problem can get, you know, three or four times the amount of work done.
Yeah, but you add 12 into it and it's a committee and then you get all sorts of problems.
Yeah, no, that gets a little too big. But every time that I, you know, I have a couple different approaches when I go into a project or a proposal with someone, but I will almost always say, at the very least, let's get together for like a day or half day charrette, and I'll just brain dump, you know, as many ideas as I can, and you guys can just, you know, cut me loose and, sure. and you don't have to work with me anymore, or we can continue on. But, you know, having that, that collaborative experience and having that initial brainstorming session to flash out a bunch of ideas is, that's, you know, one of the best parts for me. Yeah. I tend to be more of like strong in the first sort of 65, 70, 75% of the project, and then sort of need help on the finishing. I'm not more of a front end kind of, but that also includes a lot of rolling up the sleeves and cranking out a lot of work. I'm a worker and produce a lot, probably to my detriment, you know, too much work. I give the client too many options.
You can have information overload sometimes when you do that too. I always try to find that happy medium at my job of, you know, if I don't give them enough, then they're going to ask for 75 versions that they don't want. But if I give them too many, then they don't know what to pick from. So it takes even longer that way. So
I have a lot of friends that have small agencies, and they've sort of adopted this. We're going to give the client one solution because it's the right solution. I'm like, well, I don't know. That seems like that might not be the best approach. But I think that might be a client that just knows that they want to work with this person and doesn't really have any, you know, input or direction, but
they're adopting the Milton Glaser and Saul Bass approach of, you know, I'll do this for you. You're going to get one choice. It's going to be the right choice. You can take it or leave it, but.
And by the way, we went 50% up front.
Yeah. I still do that.
Yeah. No, I know that that's a smart thing to do, and I need to start doing it. And at Creative South, that was definitely one of my big sort of notes that I had written down, that that's pretty much what people are doing. You know, I'm like so sort of sheepish about asking the client for any retainer at all, but now I'm getting much better. I'm not a business guy. So I do need a business partner in some capacity.
Most of us creatives aren't. It's the rare breed that is able to do both well.
I know. Or have a partner that does that exclusively.
Yeah. Yeah, but at least you can recognize it and know that it's not your strength. And I think a lot of people are just not willing to admit that it's not their strength.
Oh, gosh, I'll give you a million things that aren't my strength. It's really just a few things that are my strength.
I'm the same way. I have a very short list of things I'm good at. The rest of the stuff I'm pretty bad at, or at the very best, mediocre at. So you're trying to cut down on travel. You know, building things, getting more retainers. What's the future looking like for you?
Well, I just recently in the past year got a new client, Kevin Plank, the CEO of Under Armour, has a development arm called Sagamore. And I worked really hard for like 2 years to get this project, but Sagamore has partnered with Pendry Hotels out of San Diego. They only have five locations, and they're the Pendry Montage Hotel brand is somewhere in between the Ritz-Carlton and the W. They're not sort of traditional old school Ritz-Carlton, and they're not
ultra modern
fresh hipster kind of. I mean, not so much hipster, but not the W. They're somewhere in between. Sure. So that's a really interesting branding position. And they partnered with Sagamore. And I was chosen to do the directional signage and graphics for the Sagamore Pendry Hotel in Baltimore, which is going into the historic Rec Pier building in Fells Point. So it's a turn of the century project that used to be a sort of a warehouse for ships to put merchandise, and then on top of the warehouse component, which actually sits out into the water, was a like basketball courts and like sort of recreational, sort of urban recreational area. And then in the front end of the building is a historic ballroom. You can imagine. So it's this weird mixture of functions. It's been sinking into the Patapsco River and been sort of a condemned structure. And Kevin Plank has been staring at it across the water for 5 years and
thought it would be a good idea to buy it.
Yeah, not unlike a lot of things that he's done that have been great for Baltimore. He bought this project and partnered with Pendry in building this luxury boutique hotel. So I really, really feel fortunate to be in this new kind of niche and having this great benchmark project to start that relationship.
Cool.
And I'm partnering with my good friend, Alexi Economou and Ashton Design in Baltimore. And they're a really accomplished environmental graphic design firm that are local. And so we're working on this project together. And we just got a second project with Sagamore. Sagamore Spirits is a whiskey brand that they distill from the water from their farm, Sagamore Farms, where they breed thoroughbred horses. It's a really great branding story. So they're doing a new distillery and restaurant that has, you know, a whiskey tasting room, and you can learn how the distilling process works. And we're doing the sort of site signage and directional signage for the visitor experience. We're not doing the interior signage, like the interpretive stuff when you're actually going into the distillery kind of component, but you know, it's another project with Sagamore, and it's a really nice client. So
and how much of this are you getting in trade?
Yeah, exactly. But I really, really feel fortunate to be working for these people, and they run a really tight ship, and we're working really hard for them. And I know that it's a scenario where if it ain't broke, it doesn't need to be fixed. And we're in with them right now. So I really like my work in Hamburg and Germany and doing this European retail components, because I get so much inspiration out of that. But I also like these other sort of domestic projects. And I would love to continue that type of work, hotels and maybe some small one-off kind of restaurants, maybe even a museum, something like that. And then continue to just do smaller local projects here in Boulder, helping people with their startup businesses, you know, just identity and collateral, kind of traditional graphic design type work. Continue the kind of relationship that I have with developers and people doing development projects that might need to integrate branding and graphics and wayfinding and things like that. And I feel like at this point I'm able to communicate well to potential clients how those types of disciplines can sort of fit into their project. You know, whether they need them or not or want them or not, I feel like I can effectively communicate why it could be useful to them or to their brand. So,
sure.
And then lastly, this kind of stuff, talking to people like you, going to events, you know, potentially speaking at events. Last fall, I spoke at the Columbus Society of Communicating Arts in Columbus at the Columbus College of Art and Design, talking about my experience and how I've sort of grown professionally through all these different opportunities. I would love to maybe teach, you know, an environmental graphic design studio class at a art college, or I just feel like I've gathered enough experience at my age that that I'm ready to share it. Originally, I thought that I was going to have a small 2-3 man agency that just for a handful of reasons didn't quite work out. So I've acknowledged the fact that I'm sort of a lone wolf on this solo mission that will include a lot of collaborative experiences with a lot of different people. And I would really like to continue to communicate what I've learned and what my insights are and how my practice can, you know, influence other people's practices or other people's lives and just develop good collaborative relationships and friendships and just grow as a person and continue to learn as much as possible. So
that's where I feel
the path is that I'm on right now. I think it's a little too late for me to ever, you know, have an office like I'd hoped, you know, like I said, with other people, not a big office, but just and again, it goes back to that whole thing about, you know, collaboration, just wanting to solve problems with, you know, a couple minds instead of, you know, being solo, so often.
Sure. So, kind of wrapping up, where can people find you online?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've found that a lot of people that are in my position don't have like the most up-to-date website. So I don't have a website.
Hey, I'm my own worst client. Yeah. So I completely understand.
But Instagram is really my favorite. I'm at Derek Friday. All, you know, one word, Derek Friday. And I use Instagram sort of like I use Finistry the blog. I celebrate a lot of my own personal work. I share a lot of ideas. I really like to do these sort of like photographic edit projects where I'm shooting images or borrowing images and then doing graphic overlays and just sort of seeing what happens. So I do a little series of those on my Instagram feed. And then I use Elo, elo.co/findustry. And Elo was started by some friends of mine here in Boulder, and it's sort of gained a lot of momentum. For a while last year, it was sort of being referred to as the anti-Facebook. It's a no advertisement Facebook type forum that's really gained a lot of momentum with the sort of creative community. It's just a great sort of tool and format for myself, for designers that I've been using. So I do post a lot of work there as well. And I'm actively working on developing a good, proper website. But the way that I solve that problem of not having a website is each client situation or each potential job, I usually like to build a little sort of custom package of ideas and concepts that I've or sure. projects that I've worked on in the past just to sort of cater. But I need a website. Absolutely.
Squarespace makes things real easy.
Yeah, exactly.
And it looks good. So, well, cool. Well, thank you again for taking the time to talk to me. It was really interesting learning more about environmental design.
Yeah, I had a great time. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate being able to communicate sort of my experiences to people. And I hope people find it interesting. So thank cool. you so much.
All right. So we end every podcast by saying, go out and hug some necks. So would you mind taking us out?
So go out and hug some necks.
That's exactly what you needed to say. Perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can follow Derek on Twitter at Findustry with two N's and check out the show notes for more ways to interact with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter at CreativeSOPod and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA or over at CreativeSouthGA.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Don't forget to head over to CreativeSouthGA.com at noon Eastern Time today to pick up your Love is Blind tickets before they all run out. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.